Thank you. I'm excited to see all of you. I thought between it being the Sunday after Christmas and then snow and ice, I'd be talking to an empty room, so I am relieved. Tommy and Elizabeth are two of our students from the high school ministry who a few weeks ago performed a drama to introduce our teaching time in Student Quest on a Sunday morning, and I thought they far more effectively introduced the topic I want to talk about today than I could, so I'm going to let them take it away for the next few minutes.
I love the zoo.
It's so awesome. They're all so cute.
Look at the monkeys.
Oh, look, they're all playing together and jumping around.
Look, they're eating bananas and bugs. And...
oh, it's making me hungry. Really? I'm going to get something to eat.
Okay.
You good?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
Man, monkeys are so cool. Sometimes I wish I could be a monkey, you know? Like, all they do is they climb around in trees with their arms going like this, and they just go, wah, all day. That's like all they say. They just go, wah. And to eat, sometimes they pick bugs out of people's hair and eat them. Just like, you know, like, wah, ah, ah, ah.
Tommy, what are you doing?
I'm being a monkey.
Wait, Kev, get back here. Wait, you're eating things out of people's hair.
Yeah, they had bugs and...
I doubt it. So what were you doing?
I was being a monkey.
Oh, you think going like this, making monkey sounds and eating things out of people's hair makes you a monkey?
Yes, I do.
You're ridiculous. I love the beach.
Oh, it's such a nice day.
Oh, it's so warm.
The waves and the sand.
Oh, the ocean looks awesome.
Yeah, it does.
I'm gonna go check it out.
Okay.
You good?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Man, look at these lifeguards. Lifeguards are so cool. They get to sit up in these really high chairs, right? And they put this white stuff on their nose. I don't know why they put it on their nose, but it looks so cool. And then they just swim around and they save lives. I bet it's just like a most amazing thing to sit up there and just think, oh, that person's drowning. I'm going to save them. I could be a lifeguard. I'm going to save somebody. I'll save you. I'm going to save you. No, come with me. You're drowning. No, it's okay. It's okay. You're going to be fine. Breathe for me, okay? Breathe.
Tommy, hey, Tommy, okay. Tommy.
Elizabeth, I saved this kid.
No, you didn't. I'm sorry. What are you doing?
He was drowning, and I'm a lifeguard, so I saved him.
He was not drowning, and you are not a lifeguard. What is on your nose?
White stuff. I don't know. I don't know why.
Oh, so you think putting white stuff on your nose, saving people who aren't drowning, makes you a lifeguard?
Yeah.
You're ridiculous. I'm so excited.
This movie looks so good.
I know. James Bond.
I hear it's got great reviews.
Really?
It's going to be a very good movie.
Oh, I'm so excited. It's going to be action scenes and...
yeah.
I'm going to go to the bathroom.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Before... you're good?
Yeah, I'm fine.
You sure?
Yeah.
You're not going to bother anybody?
I don't bother people.
The kid at the beach, all those people at the zoo.
Go to the bathroom. I'll be fine. I'll be
sure.
James Bond is the coolest guy ever. He wears a suit all the time. All the time he's always wearing a suit. And not only is he wearing a suit, but he's like jumping around in the suit. And the suit never looks bad. It looks fine. And he's got all these cool gadgets. He's got like pens that blow up and stuff. I wish I could be James Bond, just like rolling around. Just everywhere, all over the place, and finding bad guys, and like, who do you work for, huh? Who do you work for?
Tommy! This is a movie theater! What are you doing?
I'm James Bond. Look at me.
You are not James Bond. Were you rolling around?
Yes, I was rolling around. You can't be James Bond without rolling around, okay?
Wearing a suit, rolling around the floor, and interrogating innocent people does not make you James Bond. Do you think that?
Yes, I do think that.
You're ridiculous.
Hey, you know what I want to do?
What?
I want to go to church. I hear you go to church, and I want to go to church.
No.
But you're a Christian, right? You go to church every Sunday?
Yeah, but
Well, then I should go with you sometime.
You're suited for church.
Suited for church?
You bother people. You have a hard time keeping to yourself.
Maybe. But church would be so much fun. I would be really good at church. And, like, I promise I won't do anything wrong. And it'd be so much fun. Please.
Fine.
Wow. Church is cool.
Yep.
One day when
they're
all singing.
No, that's the choir. They sing.
Everybody's singing.
No.
Okay. Dear God, it's Tommy.
You pray to yourself.
To myself.
Yes.
To myself. Dear me.
No, Tom. In your head.
In my head. Okay.
Pray in your head. Amen.
Wow. Okay. Ooh, what's that thing?
Oh, offering. Just, you know.
Offering? There's money in here. Do I put more money in here?
No, just move it on.
Just move it on. Can I take some?
No. Leave the money. Just.
Okay.
Right. Just move it.
Who's that guy?
That's the pastor.
Pastor.
Yes.
What's he doing?
Preaching.
Oh. No, he wants people to go up there.
No, you just sit here.
No, but can we go up there? He wants people to go up there and say they want to be Christians.
Nobody ever goes up. Just sit.
What? So we're just going to sit here when he's asking us to go up there?
Yeah.
So wait. He wants us to go up there and say that we're Christians. Yeah. Are you a Christian?
Yes.
You think that just sitting here and mouthing along with the music and praying but not really praying and just passing along the offering and not going up and we're supposed to go up, you think that makes you a Christian? Then you're ridiculous.
Moral therapeutic deism. I figure if Bo gets to drop big words, I get to too. A few years back, they did this massive survey of young people, their parents, their churches, to analyze faith in America, in particular young people, but faith in general in America. And what they found is that while many people claim to be religious, only a small percentage are actually devoted, that the majority practiced what the scholars labeled moral therapeutic deism. Here's what they meant by it. Moral, because there was a sense of there's good and there's bad. They believe in right and wrong. Therapeutic, because it feels good. Going to church or practicing whatever their religion was, it made them feel better. You know, maybe there was a guilt if they don't go, they're going to feel bad because they grew up and they were raised. You go to church, you do whatever. So there was this therapeutic, it feels good element to it. And deism, because there's this belief or an acknowledgement in God, it's very distant, removed. I like the character that Elizabeth played because I think that in a lot of ways sums up moral therapeutic deism. She was coming to church because it felt good, made her feel better about herself. And she was kind of going along with emotions, but there wasn't a real connection. There wasn't anything of depth to it. Is that what we want? Is that what God designed us for? Is that what his hopes and dreams for the church in America are? I don't think so. You know, when we look in the Bible, I heard a speaker talking recently about the label Christian. And he was kind of making the point that the label Christian only actually appears in the Bible a few times. It was given to Christians by people who were not Christians. They didn't really understand them. They didn't know who they were. Those are those Christians over there. Since then, we've kind of embraced it and turned what they may have intended as an insult into our identity. But the label that believers in the Bible gave themselves, that appears hundreds of times in the Bible, is the word disciple, which I think sums up in so many ways so much more what God actually hopes for us. What is a disciple? A disciple is a student, someone who's actively pursuing, actively learning, actively going after God. It's the complete opposite of this moral therapeutic deism, this feel-good religion. It doesn't really have any depth to it. John 15, 5 through 8 describes what a disciple is, what Christ meant by it. Jesus speaking says, "Yes, I am the vine, you are the branches. Those who remain in me and I in them will produce much fruit." Let's pause there for just a moment. We're constantly producing fruit, right? Whatever it is that is in our life is what we produce. You know, if I'm a loving person, I'm going to produce this fruit of love, and people around me will know me for that. That's the fruit. If I'm an angry, volatile person, that's going to, as much as I might try to control it, that's going to spill out and produce angry, volatile fruit. If I'm a generous person, that fruit will come. See, we're constantly producing fruit from somewhere out of our life. And Christ is saying, if we are in him, that's the kind of fruit that we would produce as a disciple. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Anyone who does not remain in me is thrown away like a useless branch and withers. Such branches are gathered into a pile to be burned. But if you remain in me and my words remain in you, you may ask for anything you want and it will be granted. When you produce much fruit, you are my true disciples. This brings great glory to my Father. So there's this implication, direct implication, that if we are a follower of God, if we are a disciple, there will be fruit associated with that. Something will be coming from that. I was reading this book, and the author was talking about different cultural views of faith in America and the rest of the world. And she was interviewing an African Christian, and this is what she wrote. "An African Christian described it to me this way. You Americans think of Christianity as a farm with a fence. Your question is, are you inside the fence or outside of it?" I read that. I've thought that a lot over the years. You know, kind of this idea of once we accept Christ, we're there. We're in the club. You know, and even sometimes as a leader, you think, man, if I can just get them there, at least they're Christians. At least they're in the fence, right? And so he goes on to say, we Africans think differently. We think of Christianity as a farm with no fence. Our question is, are you heading towards the farm or away from it? The church's identity is not defined primarily by its edges, but by its center. I love that metaphor. Are you heading towards the farm or away from it? Many of my spiritual mentors have kind of hammered home the point to me over and over, over the decades, that in our pursuit of God, there isn't really a standing still. There isn't like a plateau, like you pursue God for a while and then you kind of hover at a certain level of spiritual growth and then maybe you continue on. Their point was always, we're either growing closer to God and growing in our Christ-likeness, or we're falling away from that, maybe dramatically, maybe imperceptibly, but either way, we're always headed in a direction. And that's why I love this question, are you heading towards the farm or away from it? And to me, that's what discipleship is all about, being a disciple, being a student. It's intentionally heading towards that farm. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11, I think paints a picture of how the entire body is called to be disciples, that the entire body is called to be ministering and actively involved in their faith, not the character that Elizabeth portrayed. In fact, in some ways, it's kind of a job description for the leaders. Ephesians 4:11 says, "Now These are the gifts Christ gave to the church. The apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, teachers. Their responsibility is to equip God's people to do his work and build up the church, the body of Christ. Their responsibility is to equip God's people to do his work, to equip, to train, to disciple, right? And then it goes on to say in verse 16, he makes the whole body fit together perfectly. As each part does its own special work, it helps the other parts grow so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. There's this incredible picture that God has called all of us to be actively involved in pursuing him, actively involved in the body, in the church, in some way. There's so much more than an hour on Sunday morning. I was excited recently, if you look in your ministry news on the second page, and by second page, I mean page 5. It's pretty close. Brandywine has always been about discipleship. We've always provided opportunities through classes, through small groups, through one-on-one, through all different ways. But recently, we've gotten really intentional about communicating that through this thing that we're calling the path. And I love it because it's very similar to that metaphor of that African Christian, you know, because this path implies we're headed somewhere. Are we headed towards God a step at a time or away from God? And so through here, we've got all these intentional ways of taking the next step in discipleship and in growth. I got particularly excited about it. I'm the youth pastor. I work with students. We all know that because Pastor Bo already said it. But filling time, apparently. I don't know. Here's the thing, though. I got excited about it because when we look at students, when we look at children in the church, sometimes in a larger church, it's easy to think that the responsibility for their spiritual development, for their spiritual growth, for their discipleship is someone else's job, right? Like we hired a youth pastor. We hired a children's director. They have tons of volunteers. There are people on it. But what I'm going to suggest, and I think some of the research is really affirming, is that it's actually the whole church's responsibility. Here's what I think that means. It's not just about parents. It's not just about individuals. It's that all of us together have a significant impact on young people. Pursuing discipleship, whether it's through the path, whether it's through a small group, whether it's through a Sunday morning class, whether it's through a service, whatever it is, pursuing discipleship has significant ramifications. It's what we were designed for. God created us to have that kind of relationship with him, and when we live that out, there is a fulfillment and a joy and a blessing that is hard to describe unless you've experienced it. It impacts the tone of our church. When we're a body of disciples, this is a much more exciting place than when we're a body of people showing up for an hour. It impacts our connection to the community. Disciples are known for their love. And that is something that spreads like crazy because that is not what most people are known for, right? And it sets the direction for the next generation. As a church, our heart has to reflect the heart of Christ when it comes to the next generation, when it comes to children. Matthew 19, verses 14 and 15 says, "But Jesus said, 'Let the children come to me, don't stop them. For the kingdom of heaven belongs to those who are like these children.' And he placed his hands on their heads and blessed them before he left." Psalm 127, verse 3 says, "Children are a gift from the Lord." They do not always feel like it at 4 in the morning, but they are. They are a reward from him. And then in Matthew 18:6, it says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. What all mafia on us. Right? The language there in those passages and over throughout the Bible communicates that God and Christ have this tremendous heart and concern and value on young people that I think all of us are called to be a part of. This study that I was referencing, it was called the National Study of Youth and Religion. They surveyed tens of thousands of young people, their parents, their churches, in professional youth ministry circles. Bet you never thought you'd hear that sentence. This is kind of the book that we've been talking about for the last several years and the study that has really shaped a lot of our conversation. Because there's never been anything quite like it. And they tracked these young people over a period of years, and what they found is kind of what I said before, that the vast majority of young people practice this moral therapeutic deism. In fact, they classified young people in four different ways as completely disengaged, sporadic, regular, you know, showing up regularly, or devoted. I don't know about you, I have four sons. My hope and prayer for them is that someday they will be described as devoted followers of Christ, that they'll have an incredible love for God, that they'll be disciples, that they'll have, the people around them will know who they belong to and who they're following. I think I speak for many people when I say that is the hope for my children. That's what I want to see. The survey found that that's true of about 8% of young people. But here's the kicker. She kind of sums it up in the first paragraph of the first chapter. She says, let me save you some trouble. Here is the gist of what you're about to read. American young people are, theoretically, fine with religious faith. But it does not concern them very much, and it's not durable enough to survive long after they graduate from high school. One more thing. We're responsible. She then goes on to say on the next page, kind of explaining the point that young people, for the most part, emulate the faith of their parents and the adults around them and their churches. Right? That in many ways, what we see in young people is actually a reflection of the adults in their lives. Sometimes young people are more honest about it. It might be surprising at first, but ask yourself, how many of us grew up in Baptist homes, and now we're Baptists? How many of you reflect the political persuasions of your parents? How many of you love the same sports teams as your parents, other than the few rebellious punks that went another way? Right? Like, in so many ways, our parents in particular and the adults in our lives have incredibly significant impact in shaping our beliefs in our pursuits, in our practices, and what we prioritize. She goes on to say, since the religious and spiritual choices of American teenagers echo with astonishing clarity the religious and spiritual choices of the adults who love them, lackadaisical faith is not young people's issue, but ours. We need, as a body, not just the parents, but as adults who care about young people, to be intentional, to be assertive, and to prioritize setting the kind of example for them to emulate that we want them to have. If I want my sons to be religiously devoted, I need to be religiously devoted. I loved this other quote. She wrote, we have not invested in their accounts. We teach young people baseball, but we expose them to faith. We provide coaching and opportunities for youth to develop and improve their pitches and their SAT scores, but we blithely assume that religious identity will happen by osmosis, emerging when youth are ready, a confidence we generally lack when it comes to, say, algebra. Right? The author is kind of communicating this point that we need to be intentional. We need to be assertive. Sometimes we need to be a little bit forceful, right? We need to teach faith to them, not just expose them to it. I'll be honest, when I first read this book, I was intimidated and overwhelmed. I have four kids, and I thought, my word, they're toast. And then I thought, this is ridiculous, because I've been a children's ministry director for 7.5 years, a youth pastor for 11 years. I went to Bible school, and then I went to college and got my youth ministry degree. I grew up as a pastor's kid. I had a lifetime perfect attendance in church, and I'm going, uh-oh, right? It's overwhelming for all of us. I want to suggest that it is not as overwhelming as we might think it is. That we can communicate, value, and pass on a faith to our young people for them to emulate through some simple steps. If you could put my slide up on the board, thank you. When they did this survey, this was the most interesting piece of information to me. Of the 8% of young people that were religiously devout, these are the six things they had in common. They didn't go looking for these things. What they did is they studied all of the devoted kids, and then they went, what do they all have in common? And these are the six things. Two of them are a little bit intangible, but four of them I think are very practical that all of us can learn from to shape the value of discipleship as a church so that our young people see it. The first one, attends religious services weekly or more. Attends religious services weekly. This has been something I've kind of hounded on for years. I think I've actually surprised some of the students over in Student Quest because I've said to kids over the years, if you're only going to be here 1 hour this week, it would be better for you to be in the intergenerational worship service than with us in the gym, but I really like you. I never know how to say that without feeling like I'm telling them, go away, you annoyed me one too many times, go over to Pastor Bo. He'll fix you. No. Here's why. There is something incredibly beneficial for all of us in the intergenerational time of worship, where you have young people, older people, middle people, I don't know, all gathered together to worship. My four kids and I and my wife, we sit up in the balcony because my kids, they like that. So it's like, all right, if it gets them in here, we'll sit up there. Anyway. They're not always into it. But I like that on an ongoing basis, they're seeing that this is a priority and it's important. Why should we be surprised when a young person graduates from high school, goes off to college, and doesn't plug into a church if they haven't been used to worshiping with other adults in their home church? It's going to be even harder somewhere else in a group of strangers. In other studies, they have found that of the small percentage of young people that do go off to college and plug into a church, 80% of them had this in common, that they regularly attended their home church's intergenerational worship service. Making this as a priority, as a family, and for the rest of us to set the example to children and families has huge lifelong impact. Faith is very or extremely important in everyday life. That's a little intangible. But in some ways, I think it's tangible in, does our language, does the way we speak, do people know that we're a follower of Christ throughout the week, or is it something our kids and the young people in our lives only hear from us on Sunday morning? Right? Because ultimately they learn from our example, not us telling them what to do. When I was little, for one of my birthdays, I was given $20 from my grandma. This was awesome because there were Star Wars toys I needed. The first thing my dad says to me when I pop this open and I'm like, I'm rich. It was the 80s. The first thing he says to me is, remember, you need to give $2 of that at church. And apparently, I got a very angry look on my face. I'm like, Matthew, what's wrong? So why do I have to give $2 if all you give is pennies and nickels? My dad was kind of shocked at first, and then he realized he was a regular tither. But none of us as his children ever saw it. When we went to church, he'd dig out whatever change was in his pockets, give it to us to throw in the offering plate, and we thought that's what he gave. So going forward from that point, he started periodically showing me the check that he was writing and turning in. My dad's a pastor. I can't remember any of the sermons he preached, but I remember being shocked at some of those numbers that my low-income pastor dad wrote on that check, right? That made an impact. We teach through example. Feels very or extremely close to God. This is another intangible thing, but I think it needs to shape our language and how we talk once again. Currently involved in a religious youth group. I like this one. Job security. Remember point number 4. Here's the deal. Not only is this worship service critical for young people as almost like an investment in their spiritual future, worshiping and pursuing God with other people their own age is an investment in their spiritual present. And it's critical. But here's what I want to suggest. Are our young people going to value going to student quests or being involved in a small group if the adults in their lives don't see the value in going to an adult Sunday school class or being involved in a small group? Right? They will reflect what we prioritize and what we make important. So if you want to see your young people in your life religiously devoted, add practices to your life that you want to see in theirs. Praise a few times a week or more. I love that it's a few. That's a lot less intimidating than 21 or 30 or 40. One of my professors used to tell me that he would get up at 4 in the morning to pray for 4 hours. And I thought, well, it's over for me. I can't hack that. I can't sit still for 10 minutes. You see me pacing all over the place. Praise a few times a week or more. How do we teach our young people to pray? Not by telling them to pray. On our mission trip to Jamaica this past summer with the students, we did a topical Bible study on Christ's prayer life. We looked at every passage in the New Testament that mentioned or hinted at Christ praying, and here was the pattern we saw. He never told the disciples to pray. He never told them, you need to do this and you need to do that, but he did go off and pray by himself every day. That came through loud and clear. And over time, the disciples, most of whom most theologians think were teenagers, started gradually coming along with him. Then they started being around him more often when he was praying, until finally it built to the point where one of them said, Master, teach us to pray. Jesus modeled to them a discipline of prayer that they began to gradually see as important and critical, and then it became something that they wanted as part of their life. Not because he told them to, but because he showed them. Do our children, do the young people in our lives see us praying? Do they see that as a regular practice in our life? If I want my sons to pray, they need to see me praying. Finally, reads scriptures once or twice a week or more. Once or twice a week or more. The most effective way that you can model to young people to read scripture once or twice or more a week is for you to be doing it. Not even necessarily dramatic about it, but just that they are aware, that they know. My wife grew up, her father used to get up every morning at 3 or 4 in the morning, I think he still does, and read his Bible before going off to work. My wife didn't get up then, But every morning she got up and saw the Bible left out on a different page. And occasionally she'd catch him in the act. But she knew that as early as he was getting up, that was still a priority, so he would get up earlier to make sure he got in the Word. If you're looking for one of these things to pick up this week, going into the year, grab one of these on the way out. Pastor Bo mentioned 52 short readings to work your way through the Bible. Do it as a family. If you don't have children in your home, still begin to build the practice of reading regularly because you want to set an example for the other young people that are a part of this body so that you can speak from experience to them. Here's what I'm going to challenge you with. This is not a beat people up message. This is a, we can be excited because there are things that every one of us can do to help change the tone of young people and the church in general in this country. And it's one step at a time. Whether it's getting involved in discipleship through the path, whether it's getting plugged into a class, whether it's getting plugged into a small group, whether it's grabbing just one of these things off this list and starting to get really intentional about it until you're ready to add a second thing and then a third thing. It's about going, discipleship is what we're called to do, and I'm going to live that out. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your word. Thank you that you call us to so much more than moral therapeutic deism. God, we thank you for the young people that you have entrusted to our lives in this church, and we ask that you would help us to model to this next generation what it means to follow you. In your name, amen.